Hi, and welcome to Net Concepts Podcast, an ongoing series of interviews, presentations, and monologues full of practical advice, insightful commentary, and important trends from thought leaders and industry practitioners in the areas of search engine optimization, e-commerce, and online marketing. Here's your host, Stefan Spencer, founder and president of SEO specialist web agency Net Concepts.
Hi, I'm Stefan Spencer, founder and president of Net Concepts. I have here with me today David Allen, who is the author of the New York Times best-selling book, Getting Things Done. He's a time management guru, and I am a huge fan of him. He's also done quite a number of workshops around the country and internationally, I believe, as well, about time management and life management, how to get things done more effectively. And I actually had the pleasure of attending one of his recent workshops in Chicago in November. So, David, thank you very much for being with me today.
My pleasure, Stefan.
So I thought we could get off the ground here just by getting an explanation from you of what is your concept of time management?
Well, you can't manage time. You actually only manage what you do during time. So the management issue is not so much about time. It's more about how do you manage your focus, how do you manage your actions and your activities, you know, in terms of what you do. That's one of the problems, Stefan, with that whole field of time management is they mislabel the problem. And because they label the problem as time, everybody thinks the calendar is going to, you know, be your solution, and it isn't.
So what is the solution then?
Well, you know, since you have to manage your actions, you have to make sure that you're taking the right actions. And in order to make sure you take the right actions, there's two very critical things you need to get clear about, and that is, you know, what does done mean? What are you committed to be accomplishing and finishing? So the sort of outcome thinking is half of the equation. In other words, to get things done, you need to know what done means, which is not always that self-evident. And the other half of the equation is you need to know what doing looks like. You know, what's the action step I need to take on this? You know, does this issue about, you know, launching a new campaign, is the next step at a computer? Is it at my boss? Is it at the hardware store? You know, where is it? What is it I need to do? So I can't manage the action unless I know what the action is. And so those are two critical things to do. As simple as that sounds, those are, as you probably know, those are not self-evident events, and you have to train yourself to do that kind of thinking on the front end.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do know all about that. So what are the biggest time stealers for most folks?
Well, again, it's not that time issue. So a time stealer, I think I know what you mean. It's like, what is it that distracts people from doing what they think they ought to be doing? And, you know, that could be as varied as there are people. There are the traditional stuff called, look, you know, well, let me just get to the bottom line. What you'll tend to avoid doing is probably the most important thing you need to do, because it'll probably be the most daunting and the most potentially successful thing you could be doing, and that's usually out of people's comfort zone. So, you know, it's a fairly normal, I don't know if it's natural, but it's certainly a normal response for people to be just procrastinating about things that are fairly significant to them. But that's, you know, people allow themselves to get distracted. I think ultimately you probably the biggest thing that gets in the way of people doing what they ought to be doing at any point in time is distraction. People allow those distractions for a lot of different reasons, but, you know, distracting means, wait a minute, I'm off purpose, I'm off course, I'm off, you know, what I should be doing. You know, a lot of what I've uncovered is what is it that creates those distractions and how do you minimize them? So, you know, one of the biggest distractions people have is that they haven't managed their own commitments. So they're sitting there thinking about trying to think about one thing and 6,000 other things are, you know, those little harpies are, you know, picking away at their brain. And, you know, that's probably, you know, and when you're not real clear about what you should be doing, you'll get sucked into whatever the latest and loudest or the easiest thing to do or the most habitual thing is that you'll need to do. So, you know, all those factors, you know, a big long answer to your question, but all those factors, I think, impinge on all of us all the time.
Uh-huh. And would you say that procrastination or getting distracted by other less important things is the biggest barrier to self-actualization?
Well, self-actualization, you know, the biggest, you know, I guess one of the biggest barriers is ourselves, you know, self-actualization. I mean, look, there's some part of you that wants to show up and express yourself and expand yourself, you know, maybe in ways that you haven't yet. In other words, there's more of you to show up here than is here yet. and whatever's keeping you from doing that. And, you know, for the most part, it's usually a self-esteem issue. It's your own image of yourself that needs to keep moving forward and keep upgrading itself. And that's a challenge we all have. But in terms of, you know, I don't know that I would get that specific about, look, if you allow yourself to be distracted, it's usually because there's some part of you that hasn't fully identified with, you know, in some positive, successful way with where you're going that would cause you to have the focus you need. In other words, a simple example, distraction is not an issue if suddenly the sirens go off and the smoke is pouring out and you can feel the heat in terms of the fire alarm. You know, you're going to get very clear. You're not probably not going to let yourself procrastinate about that because you're very clear on the outcome called live. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, suddenly your life comes, just gets all together. You're not distracted at all. You move into high performance. Most people move actually into high performance in a crisis because that creates the kind of focus that creates high performance. The problem is when your focus is created by a crisis, then the frontal lobe shuts down, essentially, you know, the frontal cortex, which is your intuitive intelligence. So you get very clever and very stupid in a crisis. And also you're pumping adrenaline into your body from which you'll physiologically crash. So crisis created high performance and focus. Yes, it will create kind of a high performance behavior, but it won't be very sustainable. Mm-hmm. And it won't be the elegance of the high performance of what if I could move into that kind of focus and lack of distraction without a crisis forcing me to do it. Now, that's the real elegance. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so a lot of people claim that they really need a crisis in order to get that focus and get into that high performance. But, of course, that just really damages your body long term because of all the stress and adrenaline.
It could. You know, I think there are times, and probably, you know, since I'm probably talking to a lot of people right now in the marketing world and advertising and PR world, that probably means there's a little bit more right brain, you know, in this population than maybe a lot of the other business populations that I would talk to. Given that, you know, there's probably a real good chance that deadline-driven, you know, creativity is well-known. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. The reason a deadline actually can work very well for you is what it forces you to do is make decisions. So it's not so much that, you know, that if you've got a deadline, you know you're going to finally have to decide, okay, look, that's the piece of art. No, that's the copy. It's just going to have to go. As opposed to, oh, gosh, it's got to be perfect. I mean, just imagine if you had to turn in something early, think how good it would have to be. But if you can wait to the deadline, you can always, you know, pretend like it could have been better if I'd had more time, but I finally had just had to make a decision. You know, so there's a lot of reasons why deadline-driven may actually, you know, is not necessarily a bad thing. It just, all it does is it speeds up and it makes you be a little more proactive about decision-making.
Right.
You know, because I do the same thing. Come on, you know, if I've found that packing, you know, I like to make sure I have the right clothes. But if you know, especially in the spring or fall, if you're going to a city that it could be extremely cold or extremely warm or wet or dry, and you have all those options, man, I could spend 4 days agonizing over all the stuff I should take in the suitcase. So I always wait till the last 30 minutes, you know, before I need to walk out the door to pack, because that just forces me to make those decisions. Now, that's not a bad thing. I just sort of have come to accept that. I just have fun with it, and that's the way I play it. So it's not necessarily, I think, a bad thing that we use deadlines to some degree to our advantage. Mm-hmm.
Well, it can create stress, though. So how do you manage that stress? What are your favorite de-stressors to help manage that?
Well, I think stress only comes from the fact that you think you should be doing something, then you're not. So that's where negative stress anyway. I think positive stress is actually a good thing. You know, sort of the stretch goal, the wow, you know, let me see how much faster I can run. Let me see, you know, how many more ideas I can generate in 5 minutes. You know, so I think that kind of stress that you put yourself into a challenge, you know, kind of situation is actually a very good thing. If we didn't have any stress, we'd never grow, and you probably wouldn't test your mettle, and you probably wouldn't come up with a lot of creative stuff that people come up with by being somewhat on that edge. But I think what you're saying is, you know, like, look, if you find yourself sitting there stressing and it's not producing anything of value other than, you know, toxicity in your body, then, you know, probably a good idea would be to shift gears. You know, probably the way you're seeing things and from where you're seeing it is not the right altitude or attitude. So a good idea is get up and walk around, change your focus. You know, and there are lots of good ways to do that. You know, you just go for a run, go for a walk, just get up and walk around, stand up, sit down, do something different than what you're doing. Physical movement will sometimes shift your gears as well. Now, those are just some of the more, so just, you know, dealing with the symptoms and dealing with the physiology. And, you know, I use those all the time because you're never going to get rid of stress here. I mean, gee, you know, there's a loud noise out there. Just sound is a stressor on the body. Just, you know, so we kind of live in a world that's got all kinds of inputs for us, so we oftentimes are just having to shake that off in other kinds of ways. You know, I think the topic you're dealing with here when we talk about personal productivity, time management, procrastination, et cetera, those stressors you actually can address, but those are not sort of necessarily instant sorts of things. Well, they are in a way. You can, you know, one of the things you can ask yourself is like, wait a minute, what is the thing that is most bothering me right now? And how could I resolve that quickly? And, you know, that takes some guts to step up to the plate and look at what those things are. You know, the old Gestalt theorem, the way out is through, has a lot of good advice for us there. But one of the things I'm teaching these days, and one of my favorite sort of concepts now, is that paying attention to what has your attention is a very valuable thing to do. So if you're in a stress modality, real good idea is to ask yourself, if you're willing to be honest with yourself, and say, okay, wait a minute, what right now, if it were handled, resolved, finished, clarified, or whatever, would take the biggest pressure off me? And sometimes it's just having a conversation with your boss, or, you know, maybe going and finding out what somebody really does think about you as opposed to fretting about it, or finding out if you can renegotiate with the powers that be this thing that looks like it's going to be late. You know, all those good, just common sense things, but those are often what are creating the stress. Mm-hmm. So it's not a bad idea to be somewhat self-aware in terms of what's the source of mm-hmm. it.
So for somebody who is implementing your methodology of GTD or getting things done, there's quite a transformation for those who actually adopt GTD and stick with it and really do apply it in their lives. What's a typical before and after in terms of what somebody is going to look like before and after they adopt GTD?
Well, you know, it's funny. From the outside looking in, it may not look that different. Even somebody's office may not look that different. The difference would be, you know, here's one of the subtleties of it, is you might look at somebody and they've got a sports bag lying around their office and they've got, you know, reports and piled up on one corner of their desk, and they've got a folder of, you know, a big project right in front of them, and they've got six more project folders sitting on the side. So before and after doesn't mean that they're suddenly going to, they have a messy desk and now they're going to have a totally clean desk, though that may happen. Before and after means before, you're sitting there and there's a lot of decisions not made about all that stuff lying around you. The sports bag actually represents, oh, gee, I'm supposed to call and, you know, there's somebody who invited me to a tennis game, but I haven't gotten back to him yet, but I haven't decided what to do about that. And, oh, yeah, I need to re-up my membership. And, you know, in other words, there's embedded all kinds of decisions and things inside of all those. That's the before, and people just sort of live in that kind of gnawing sense of anxiety. So they're not even that aware that they're that stressed out. Afterwards, they may be sitting in an office that looks very similar to that, but guess what? They're sitting there going, da-da-da-da-da, wonder where I should focus next. Because what they've done is they've actually taken all those things that were impinging on their psyche, made the appropriate decisions about them, parked the results of that thinking in some appropriate place, and now they're actually sitting there with much less stress, much more efficient because they're not rethinking things back or forth. They're leaving work, you know, half an hour sooner. They're plowing through their email, you know, in probably 40% of the time that it used to take them to do that. And they're, you know, they're ready for surprise. They're sitting there and say, hey, you know, suddenly get interrupted. That's okay. You know, I now know where to park that and how to engage with it. So it's a little subtle. It's not, it may not be a, you know, suddenly you see a, you know, before person totally, you know, scatterbrained and out of control, and, you know, and then suddenly you see somebody, you know, kind of anal and sitting at their desk totally clean. It's not really not like that at mm-hmm. all.
Would you say somebody who's in the after state of adopting GTD is more adept at being able to say no?
Yes. Very, very simply. Uh-huh. Mainly because if you don't know what you're not doing, it's hard to feel comfortable about what you're not doing. Mm-hmm. So you know, if you really haven't managed the total inventory of all the commitments, you kind of almost out of your integrity have to take on any commitment anybody of authority asks you to do, simply because you don't know how much you've got, and maybe you could do it in, oh, damn. As opposed to, here's the 65 projects I have. You've been staring at them and, you know, reviewing them on a constant basis with all the attendant actions. It's going to be a little easier for you to, you know, say, excuse me, you know, wait a minute. You know, I'm going to have to either say, can we renegotiate this thing? Or if I do that one, these others are going to have to drop off. Those are not easy conversations to have, but they're almost impossible to have if you haven't got an idea of what your inventory is.
Mm-hmm.
But getting really clear about what you're not doing, meaning, you know, clarifying what are all your commitments at all the different levels you've got them, and being able to see those and review them and be objective about those on some consistent basis, just matures up your ability to make those kind of hard decisions and the triage and say, whoops, just, you know, thank you very much, just sorry I don't have the bandwidth to commit to that.
Mm-hmm. So somebody who's really got that good inventory of what's on their plate and what needs to be done and when, they've constantly been checking this over, and part of the process of being able to be up to date with what your commitments are is a weekly review. Now, you've stated before that this weekly review is an extremely important component of GTD. Could you explain the significance of the weekly review?
Sure. Actually, you need to review a lot of things at a lot of different levels. If I, you know, your calendar review is probably, you know, certainly as important tactically as a weekly review. You know, you finish getting off this, you know, interview with me, Stefan, you know, what are you going to do next today? You know, and if some part of you hasn't looked at your calendar and your other commitments down at that mundane and tactical level, you know, you're going to be stressed out. The next level up from that in terms of the horizons of your stuff would be the kind of things that you probably ought to be looking at, not necessarily every hour or even every day, but at least once a week. And that's the level that, you know, we identify as projects. And that's, we have a very broad definition, meaning anything you want to finish that's going to take more than one step to get there that you can probably finish within the next few weeks or months would be a project. And given that definition, which includes things like, you know, research a new cell phone service, you know, hire an assistant, restructure my department, you know, launch the new campaign, get a dog, you know, all those things. If you include all of those, most people have between 30 and 100. And that review of that list of those 45 or 72 things like that on some consistent basis, you're not going to have the time or bandwidth when you're going through the day-to-day crank it out to be backing off and looking at that inventory kind of as a whole group of things. And so that kind of once a week look that's for the most part driven by a review of all those things we call projects and sort of bringing up the rear guard and identifying the new projects that have shown up. You know, anyone listening to this podcast right now, I guarantee you in the last 3 to 4 days, there have probably been at least two or three things that have shown up that are now represent problems or situations or issues or circumstances that you've got some level of commitment to finish something about that, but you haven't yet had time to sit down and clearly identify what it is you're committed to finish as a project and what the action steps are on it. The question is, when are you going to do that? Because I don't have time to make those decisions either when the world is coming at me so fast and furious. But if I let that go too long, boy, that backlog will mount up psychologically on me and very quickly and just start to numb me out. So that's why I discovered, you know, once a week you better sit down and hold the world back and sort of, as I say, bring up the rear guard. You know, identify the new projects that have occurred, you know, mark off the old ones that have finished, catch up all the ones that are still pending in terms of what's now next on them and you know, get real current and complete about that stuff. And, you know, that seems to be the reason we stress it so much is because it seems to be the most lacking. There are people out there at the vision mode who may be doing, yeah, their brains in the blue sky and they're doing all kinds of vision and purpose and mission and brainstorming and all that. And they got a phone list of people to call this afternoon, but they don't have, not doing much in between. And it's that in between sort of operational review that seems to be the most lacking and also has the greatest potential, I think, to relieve the most stress if that's done appropriately.
Mm-hmm. So why is it that the weekly review, which is extremely important, why is that the area that GTD practitioners fall off the wagon the most? And how do they turn that weekly review into a habit that really sticks?
You know, I don't know, Stefan, that I really know. I just know that it is a very, very challenging habit for people to build in. I think because it's not an in-your-face kind of thing, you know, whereas your calendar, if you forget the appointment, they'll yell and scream and you'll feel really bad really quick. But the weekly review, it's kind of like you don't get that kind of negative instant feedback, you know, if you don't do it. But I think it's because it's a little more subtle kind of habit.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a lot of people brush their teeth, but not that many floss. So it's almost like training yourself to, wait a minute, you know, I better get used to flossing because otherwise I'm not brushing in between my teeth. Maybe it's because it's a more subtle habit, you know, where the feedback is not that immediate to you, that it's sort of challenging for people to build in that habit.
Yeah.
And if you wanted to build in that habit, you've got to do exactly how you learn to brush your teeth. You've just got to get real used to what it feels like being as clean as it feels to do that weekly review, so you can't stand anything less.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I do a weekly review and I empty my in-baskets to zero for the same reason that I brush my teeth. If I don't, the scuzz factor just gets too high. I just can't stand not doing it.
Makes sense.
And, by the way, Stephen, everybody has a certain level of unprocessed stuff they'll let mount up until they feel uncomfortable. You know, I have a favorite saying that if the good fairy showed up and just disappeared everybody's emails right now, you know, within about 10 days, everybody would have pretty much the same number of emails they currently have. Because it's not about the volume. It's like how many of those things you let pile up before some part of you feels uncomfortable not doing something with them.
Mm-hmm.
And some people will have 30, and some people have 300, and some people have 3,000. And it has absolutely nothing to do with the volume of emails they're getting. It has to do with how many they let mount up.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings me to another topic that I really resonate with, and that's your philosophy of inbox zero and keeping your email really at bay by emptying it every night, right before you go to go home for the
day.
Well,
every 24 to 48 hours probably makes a pretty big difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that'd be ideal. I don't do it, you know, every night. It's not at zero, but pretty close.
So why is this important?
Well, it's, you know, when it say get it to zero, it's like the as far as I'm concerned, the bigger your backlog, the harder it is to deal with surprise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's a hypothetical. What if you knew, this is kind of an oxymoronic idea, but what if you absolutely knew there was a huge surprise coming towards you in 5 days? Huge. Humongous. One of the biggest in your life. Could be good, could be bad. You don't know what the content of the surprise is. You just know it's going to be a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
What would you be doing? Would you be just letting your email pile up? Or are you going to be getting ready, you know, for a surprise? And how would you get ready for surprise? Probably, if you were me, I'm going to be getting rid of every single open loop, clarifying every single thing so that when something happened, I had total flexibility and no residue on me, either physically or psychologically, so that I could recalibrate and refocus on whatever this thing was. In the same way, I say, you know, when do you think people feel best about their work? Well, it's a week before their vacation. It's not about the vacation. It's about what they're doing in order to be able to free up their psyche so they can walk on the beach or play 18 holes.
Right, and they're clearing the
deck.
What's that? Yeah.
Hey, they're grabbing it, they're capturing it, they're clarifying it, and then they're renegotiating all those agreements with themselves and all the other people involved so that some part of them knows that somebody's going to handle feeding the cat and somebody's going to handle these three client phone calls and, you know, and all that's done. I just suggest people do that weekly. You know, not yearly, but if you catch the idea of that, that's why maintaining your backlog at zero is just becoming, you know, that's not a nice to have, that's going to be a must have, you know, if people really want to stay sane in this kind of, you know, the world. I mean, nobody's getting any less input than they were last year,
mm-hmm.
at least I know of.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's increasing. Well, the speed of life is accelerating, and technology's accelerating, and just trying to keep up seems to be a losing battle for a lot of people.
You know, and I think the problem, Stephen, is not that there's always new input. There's always new input coming in, and we seem to, you know, your psyche just seems to only let in a certain amount, you know, and then it tend to blow a fuse. But the truth is, what a lot of people haven't learned to do is to quickly determine what stuff means and then dispatch it so that they can get rid of it and park it over there where it belongs, et cetera. And I think, you know, people, you know, may be pretty good about taking in new input, but they're not really good yet about learning how to drop it off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've already got a lot more to do than you can do. So if you take on something new, something else got to get dropped off. Otherwise, that's just a formula for burnout.
Right.
But that training yourself to be able to drop stuff off, you know, as fast as things are coming at you, that's tricky business.
Mm-hmm.
And that requires that you don't sit there and don't decide about the stuff coming at you. So learning to make executive operational decisions about what things are, what they mean, and what you're going to do about them and where they need to go in your life, you know, on the front end instead of the back, it's just a lot of what GTD is about.
Right. One critical behavior in GTD is delegating. There's this concept floating around that's been popularized by Tim Ferriss, author of the 4-Hour Workweek, of using a virtual assistant to do everything possible. He even has had his virtual assistant do his online dating for him. You know, so what do you think of these virtual assistants? They're typically located in India or, you know, somewhere overseas, and delegating much of your life, both personal and professional, to this army of individuals you've never met.
Well, I can't say anything specifically about that from my own experience because I don't use them over there. I have my own assistant, but quite frankly, I need all the help I can get from anybody who can do something that, instead of me, if it costs less money for them to do it than me to do it. So that's just stupid, mm-hmm. because I got enough stuff to do. So anything I can hand off to anybody, no matter where they are, whether they're in India or next door, I will probably hand off to them unless I just like doing it. I mean, delegating is, I happen to like, filling my bird feeders and going and watering my bonsai, which are, you know, fairly low-level tasks, but I need a big set of low-level tasks that I enjoy doing to shift gears from time to time, so I don't want to delegate those away. It's nice when I can, as if I had have people to do it, but the simple answer to it is absolutely anything that and then course correct, check it out. If you hand it off and it screws up, that's just, don't let that happen more than once.
Mm-hmm.
But just live and learn. So there's nothing specific about that specific thing that's any different than anyone else. I mean, it's a virtual world. You and I are closer together than you are with your neighbors right now. So, it's all one place, really. So there's, time and space are, have to sort of compress themselves. So really nothing about where it is or who it is, or how far away geographically they are, mm-hmm. just as can they produce the result that you need so your mind is freed up from it. I mean, dating, it's fine. If you don't want to be involved in that and let somebody sort of filter all that and give them to you, like, what the heck? India would be a great place for that. That's what they do, isn't it?
Funny. So one thing that I think can't be done really virtually, but really needs to be done in face-to-face is life coaching. What do you think of life coaches?
Well, anybody who wants to improve their life, could probably take advice from anybody who gives them advice. So what the heck? If what you mean by, is identify one person that you'd say, is the person to stick with, I mean, frankly, I'll take advice from anybody who can improve anything I want to improve. So my life is a coach, so, you can be a coach to me. Anybody who gives you information that might be useful to you. I think, what you're talking about is all those people that are sort of parading themselves as life coaches out there, and some of those folks are probably doing great work, but a life coach can only take as far as they are. So you better find somebody who's ahead of your game in terms of their style, their energy, and what they're about. Otherwise, you might be doing yourself a disservice by, putting yourself in their hands. Mm-hmm. If you're into growing yourself at all, you'd be silly not to leverage, good advice or good input or good energy that you might be able to get from anybody.
Mm-hmm. So if you implement GTD and you get to this stage of mind like water, what does that free you up to do? I mean, why is mind like water so important?
That's up to you. I have a simple little thing that's like, look, you either like what you're doing, in which case doing it with less effort, and getting more results from the energy you put into it would seem like a good idea, or you don't particularly care about what you're doing, you just have to do it anyway, then doing it as efficiently as you can so you can get out of there as fast as you can and do something else you like to do better, all that makes a lot of sense to me. So my whole thing was, well, what are just the easiest practices that you can get stuff done with as little effort as possible? So I'm not really, I guess on a personal level, I might qualitatively coach people about, you know, about what they want to do with an empty head. I'm just suggesting an empty head happens to be the easiest way to get stuff done with the least amount of distraction and the least amount of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it's the easiest way to get access to, resources that you might not have otherwise. Which resources you want and how you want to use them, up to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's not my job.
Right. So for me, getting to mind like water is really about being more into the flow and being more productive and less distracted, and I could focus on whatever I consider to be important, and it just helps me get to that place faster.
Yeah, and you'll probably live longer too. I mean, because it will tend to relieve the kind of stress that produces the kinds of stress-related diseases that they're attributing a lot of people's deaths to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, death is something none of us that I know of are going to get away from, so what? But, if you happen to like your life or want to use it for whatever reason, then anything that was going to relieve any of the pressure off you that may be unhealthy as opposed to expansive is probably going to be a useful thing to do.
Right. Well, considering the finite amount of time that we all have on this earth, you'd think that we want to use it most effectively and most wisely, but yet the average American watches 7 years of TV during their lifetime. I mean, it makes no sense to me. I mean,
yeah.
I'm curious, do you watch much TV?
No.
Okay. Neither do I.
People always say, have you seen? I say, what's that? I hardly even watch sports anymore. Like basketball, is that a round ball? and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, come on. I go out and water my plants and feed birds. I mean, that could look as dumb as watching TV, I guess.
But it's actually getting out there and doing something, and whereas sitting in front of the TV is...
Yeah, I mean, TV does tend to be a bit narcotic. I'd say surfing the web probably be a better way to distract yourself in terms of simply because it is engaging and you do have to be somewhat proactive in terms of what you do.
Mm-hmm. But even that is kind of...
But there are times to zone out. I watched a Bruce Willis action movie last night. Something just lying on the couch with my dog sprawled out on my stomach. It was one of the nicer moments of my day.
So rather than, let's say, watching TV or just surfing the web, what would you say is a better habit to get into when you get home tired from work and you feel like vegetating?
I don't know. Yoga's great. I like good wine. A good massage is fabulous. I had one of those last night too. Gardening is great. Any kind of natural stuff is fine. I think anything in moderation, as long as you have a balance in your life, is fine. Any of those things can be taken certainly to where they're not in moderation and you're out of balance. And that's just, how aware are you of whether the balance is working in your life,
mm-hmm.
About that. So I think, if you've got a thought process, if I'm working on a new book and just struggling through trying to write things and think and whatever, I'm probably not going to have some sort of a mental exercise as a way to relieve my, to get some balance. I'm probably going to go walk around, go for a jog or, do something physical. And vice versa, a very physical day, then I might want to sit down and read a book or do something the other way around. So again, just kind of just being practical about it. Well, what are the different aspects of your expression and your experience, and are you balanced on a daily basis about that?
Mm-hmm. One problem I have, I've labeled it as urgency addiction, is I tend to get sucked into the quadrant of the urgent and not so important instead of the important but not urgent. What's a quick or effective way to break that habit of urgency addiction?
I don't know. I mean, ultimately, the urgencies are urgent. If they truly are urgencies, you can't break it by stopping doing that. Because they are urgencies, so you have to stop doing that. I think you have to, you have to look at, okay, wait a minute, how do I deal with this chain of events a little more on the front end, so that the urgencies aren't showing up.
Mm-hmm.
You have to decide whether the urgency really is urgency or not, or whether you just made it an urgency as a way to avoid other things you really ought to be doing.
Yep, that's a very good point.
How urgent of it is it to go run to the hardware store and buy the thumbtacks that you need because you saw this cool picture you want to stick on your wall. Well, you could make that an urgency. Oh, I have to go do that because I'm inspired and I want to go do that. I mean, if that's what you're talking about in terms of urgency, and you really need to be writing the next chapter of your book or sitting down and drafting a proposal for a client because they're tapping their fingers and waiting for it by 3 o'clock, you know, that's just procrastination and avoidance by finding some other, you know, pseudo-urgent thing to as a way to distract you. Mm-hmm. You know, but if it truly is the client's calling and they need it by now, and that's gonna, your job is on the line if you don't get it to them, you know, and you're going, yeah, that is urgent. And they say, yeah, no kidding. You know, but how come you waited this late to move on it? You know, had you been reviewing that in your weekly review from the time you had that project on your list and had next actions on it moving forward, so that they were just moving forward in the naturalness of your days, as opposed to waiting to decide what to do. There's a whole different story. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the busy person that you tend to delegate to because you know they're going to get it done. And so if that person doesn't know how to say no, they'll very quickly get caught up into the world of the urgent because they're just getting stuff piled on them to no end.
Sure, and if anybody's been paying attention who's dealing with them, you're going to stop giving it to them because you know that's not going to be an effective funnel to throw it in. Mm-hmm.
So on a kind of a similar sort of idea here, if somebody is already quite burdened with a lot of to-dos, let's say they've got an overwhelmingly long to-do list, and they've already processed it with, through GTD, so they know what the context and next actions and all that are, how should someone break past the mental barriers that they might have when facing that overwhelmingly long to-do list? Right? So you're in multiple contexts. You're at the office, so you could be on the phone or you could be on email or any number of different agendas and so forth, but it's all so darned overwhelming because there are like 300 things that you could be doing at that moment.
Yeah. Well, there are two answers to that. The deeper answer is, well, you know, you need to be reviewing the horizons of focus, and you need to be looking up and you know, not staring at the action level, but you need to be, you know, really maturing your thought process about, okay, what's your job and what's your critical deliverables there, and where do you want to be a year from now about your job or your career, and where are you going 3 to 5 years from now, and what's the vision that's driving you in terms of career and lifestyle, and you know, and what's really, really, really important to you in your life, and you know, those kinds of good discussions that we all need to have with ourselves that are tough stuff to grapple with on a regular basis, but you know, you can't get away from that. Those ultimately are going to be. There's always more to do than you can do, and the only way you can feel comfortable about what you are doing is making sure you've got some sense of an internalized sense of priorities. But that's not a simple ABC priority, because all those different things I just mentioned are different horizons that we need to look at and evaluate and sort of put all those in my intuitive mix about them. Okay, well, which ones are okay that I'm not doing right now, and which ones really, really are important? You know, so there is a good reason. You know, I talk about not having daily to-do lists because those have to get rewritten so much. But the truth is, you really need to sit down and say, okay, look, if there's only one or two or three or six things out of all of these 300, which ones are going to give me the highest payoff if they're actually marked off this list? You can't get away from that sort of constant, you know, prioritizing and triaging, you know, based upon your own intuitive guidance about it. So you can mature your intuitive guidance. And also, I've discovered, too, that people tend to go a bit numb to these lists. So if you had to rewrite those lists every time you sat down and looked at it, it'd make it a lot different. You know, I just interviewed a guy on my GTD Connect, which is our, you know, membership program that we have. And Alan Nelson and his wife, his wife had a baby, their first one, and he took off. He took a kind of a hiatus and a little bit of a sabbatical for a couple of months. And he went back from computerized lists of his actions. He's a big GTD fan, but he went back to paper. He said he just wanted to just see what it was like, and he went back to paper-based lists, and he said it was fascinating to him because he discovered that it made his action list a lot more vital and real because he had let himself go numb to all those things too simply because it was so easy to insert them on the computer, so easy to just glance at them and not pay much attention to them, just say, gee, I got a big list. But if you had to sit down and really rewrite them, they'll make you rethink, am I really going to call that guy? You know, how really important it really is that? And, you know, and it gets you back into, you know, kind of forcing, if you will, those intuitive decisions about how important is this stuff.
Wow, that's great. I'll have to listen to that one. I'm actually a member of GTD Connect, so Have to check that one out.
Oh, cool. Well, it's coming, actually. Yeah, it's not out yet, but it'll be, I think, the next one out.
Okay. So I have just two more quick questions. First, you probably have heard of Google's policy of 20% time, where Googlers are empowered to use 20% of their work time for their own projects. So how can that work if many of the staff already have an overwhelming workload on their plate?
It's huge. It's a huge problem. You know, nothing's free. So either have a highly structured job where all, you know, everything you do is nice and clear and laid out for you, and then you don't have a whole lot of freedom, but you can relax a lot because there's not a lot of other options. Or you can have a totally free job where you can just do whatever the heck you want, and everybody's looking at you. then you're overwhelmed with opportunity. So, you know, none of those is free. You know, Second Life is a client. I've done some work for those folks, and they have the same sort of idea. I mean, basically anybody can work on anything they want. It's just, it's all transparent. So fine to do what you want. Just, it's going to be online so everybody can see what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
The good news about that is, of course, hey, you know, you become then the challenge. How cool can your idea be so you can, you know, so you can enlist people onto your project. So, you know, you've got the challenge for that. And you know, I think there's probably a lot of creativity that comes out of environments that can do that. But, again, everybody personally is then still going to have all those issues. Go, wow, they got a cool thing. I could go work with them. Oh, but they got a cool thing, too. Well, I could go work on that. Oh, my God. There's, you know, there are two or three cultures. And there's one of them, you know, very well known, you know, up in the boutique, you know, global investment bank world. That has a culture very much like that too, where everybody, you know, kind of it's hard to say no to anything, and everybody's kind of there's a huge collaborative culture where all kinds of people input on all kinds of stuff. And the bad news about that is that people can very, very quickly overwhelm themselves. So being smart about what you decide to do, it comes back to those same issues you're never going to get rid of, which is, okay, given where I'm going, who I am, what I'm committed to, and what all this is about, what are the things that I am committed to? Should they be the things I'm committed to? That doesn't change no matter what the culture is.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, my last question is related to a kind of a larger purpose. So many folks feel an overwhelmed and hopeless feeling regarding what can be done about the world's problems. You know, so many of them: global warming, endangered species, destruction of the Amazon rainforest, overpopulation, children starving, world poverty, human trafficking. You know, I could go on and on.
Mm-hmm.
So can GTD help folks actually make a real difference while still balancing their own needs for time at work, time with the family, et cetera?
Make a difference, meaning for them personally or for the world?
Yeah, both, really.
Yeah, well, it can. I mean, if what you're doing is just, if what you're trying to do is to create results that aren't here yet, certainly anything that can facilitate that. That's why we try to do, you know, we try to give as much of our work pro bono as we can to people really doing good work in the not-for-profit sector. Because if I can help people who are helping people, and they can by using GTD, they can help a lot more people with a lot less stress, and so they can do it more sustainably, you know, then I've really leveraged what this is about. So I'm a big believer in, look, if you got something good to do, give it to good people doing good work. You know, and
mm-hmm.
that's, you know, I think that's a great thing to do. You know, so yes, in general, that certainly will help. So anything that helps you be healthier, keep a better, you know, will allow you to have a healthier perspective on life. And, you know, it's either half empty or half full. I mean, the world's no worse off than it was in 1263 or 1942. You know, like, well, you can go focus on all the bad stuff, or you can say, okay, and so what are we going to improve? And, you know, how do we move things forward and, you know, take it in some positive, productive engagement?
Mm-hmm.
So I think GTD is just, as a stylistically, is a good message for everybody. It's called, okay, no matter how bad it is, your perspective is the most valuable thing in the world. I mean, people could have what looks like a life in the pits and still be on if you have the appropriate perspective. And people could have what looks like an abundant, successful life and want to take their life if they have the inappropriate perspective, if you can't see it from the right angle. So being able to view life or any situation from the appropriate angle, I think, is a master skill, you know, or a master behavior set or ability. And certainly for knowledge workers that were thinking and, you know, and contemplating, you know, things are a lot of what life is about and what their work is about. And that's why I think GTD is an extremely, I think that's why its time has come. I mean, I keep selling more books, you know, every year than I did the year before, and the book's been out there for a while. You know, I think it just hit a nerve, and I think that's why. You know, it really is a very practical way to you know, kind of stop the noise and get sort of back in the driver's seat instead of feeling battered around by, you know, by the vicissitudes of life. Mm-hmm. And once you catch that, you can keep graduating that to higher levels. In other words, create some cheap wins to begin with, and then you'll take on some, you know, bigger challenges and move it forward.
Right, and you can start actually living in the more in the 50,000-foot view instead of the runway and the 10,000-foot view all the time.
Sure. Well, it all comes down to actions anyway. It all comes down to the runway. All those other things are just things to, you know, to integrate, to think about, to contemplate, reflect on, so that then the actions that you take, it all comes down to emails and phone calls and open your mouth and walk your body. Mm-hmm. So, you know, everything ultimately comes down on this level anyway to this level, which is physical, your physical behavior. But obviously how you feel about it, and, you know, at the end of the day that you felt like you took the behaviors you should have is a lot of, you know, what I think GTD can facilitate.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for your time, David. Really appreciate it. Any closing thoughts or anything that you'd like to share?
Nope. Just, you know, it's easier than people think to actually do all this. And, you know, come on in.
Thanks for listening to Net Concepts Podcasts. Net Concepts is one of the leading voices for search engine ready e-commerce, listing clients such as Kohl's, HSN, REI, Cabela's, Discovery Channel, Verizon, Superpages, and Yahoo. Want to learn more about SEO, e-commerce, web marketing, email marketing, blogging, or social media? A wealth of material, including podcasts, screencasts, webinars, white papers, articles, and blog posts, can be found on our website at www.netconcepts.com. Until next time.